WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center, and always on the Civic Media app.
This is a special report from ABC News. I'm Richard Cantu.
Like, man, what's going on?
That man on the northeast side of Philadelphia, where a jet ambulance with six people aboard crashed shortly after takeoff, crashing into houses and cars on the street.
I go to the gym to relieve stress, and you hear the boom, and you see everything, but you just see the plane getting lower and lower.
Philadelphia Mayor Sherelle Parker.
As of right now, we have no reports on the number of fatalities. So right now we're just asking for prayers for any and everyone who may have been affected.
One of the six people aboard the jet ambulance was a child.
Several dwellings and vehicles were impacted. So what are we asking you to do for us right now, Philadelphia? We're urging you to please stay away from the scene.
Pennsylvania's Governor Josh Shapiro was said to be heading for Philadelphia. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
The Packers making changes on their coaching staff. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports. ESPN reporting the Packers plan to hire DeMarcus Covington as their next defensive line coach. Covington was the Patriots defensive coordinator last year. He was hired by Bill Belichick and was New England's defensive line coach when they won their most recent Super Bowl 5 years ago. But the Packers are losing linebackers coach Anthony Campanelli. After just 1 year in Green Bay, Campanelli is 42. He grew up in New Jersey playing linebacker at Rutgers.
I started out as a high school coach. I grew up around high school football, you know, my father and my brothers and everything. So that's really where my background is.
College basketball. The Badgers hope to bounce back after losing at Maryland. Wisconsin will be at Northwestern tomorrow. Tip-off time, 1 o'clock. Number 9th ranked Marquette at home in Milwaukee against UConn tomorrow night. Game time, 7 p.m. The Bucks road trip continues tonight in San Antonio against the Spurs. Damian Lillard named to the All-Star team. He'll be joining Giannis as a reserve. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Open that conversation with this person that you disagree with so much by trying to find the shared value, the thing that you both actually agree about. Challenge yourself to keep bringing it back to the value that we agree on and maybe even the outcome that we wish to see. Go have the tough conversation, because you know what gets better with practice? Those tough conversations.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Tuesday, Trump does his thing. We're going to cut all funding. Sorry, kids, no school lunch. Sorry, granny. We're going to kick you out of the nursing home, no Medicaid. Slash, burn, close the purse. It's over. Wednesday, rescind the whole thing. And I understand, this is the kind of chaos we expect from Trump. And I know a lot of people are saying, well, you know, it's because people came in and they expressed outrage. And some of that was true. I think it was more of a jab. I think it was more, hey, let's throw some stuff out there. Let them go crazy. Get them all lathered up. And then, we changed our mind. And understand, we're going to see a lot of this. We're going to see an awful lot of chaos for chaos' sake, because this is who they are. Now, do they want to freeze all federal spending? Yeah. Do they want to gut Medicare? Sure. Do they want to gut Medicaid? Abso-freaking-lutely. Now, what's interesting was watching the right. Now, everyone's been focused on the left and Democrats on how they all mobilized together and expressed outrage, rightfully so. But the right fell, well, right into line. And they did so in a way that just makes me go, is there any hope for them? I mean, honestly and truthfully, is there any hope for these people? Is there any hope for a party that just, you know, we're going to go along to get along. Whatever dear leader wants, dear leader gets. Yeah, don't worry about it. And understand, you know, we've talked about it this week about the fact that that absolutely they were going to destroy a lot of funding programs. A lot of people were going to get hurt. And I said, you know, yesterday that understand. Hello, this is what's coming. This is what they want to do. They want to literally take food out of the mouths of children. They do want to kick granny to the curb. They do want to do these things because it's who they are. And understand that it's not going anywhere. They're going to continue to do this stuff. They're going to continue to bring this kind of chaos because, again, it's who they are. It's flooding the zone. I mean, pretty simple. We're just flooding the zone. We're just causing as much chaos as possible. And look, my problem is what did we miss? What in all this did we miss? While we were focused on the craziness, while we were focused on what they were shoveling, what did we miss? You know, for instance, spent a little time thinking about Georgia Representative Rich McCormick, who was on CNN saying that, you know, those kids, they should go get jobs. Those kids need jobs. He said that children should be thinking about their future instead of thinking about how they're going to sponge out of the government and when they don't need it. And you go, that's where he starts from. Kids needing food is setting them up to be sponges. Now, never mind that they're going to go hungry if there isn't food on the table. Never mind that. It doesn't care. But they're going to become little sponges. And this is the thinking of those on the right, that if we have a social program, there are going to be, everyone's going to abuse it. Will there be some? A handful? Yeah, yeah. But the vast majority of people, unfortunately, are just hungry and need a helping hand. And I look at myself as one of those. You know, going through school, my mother didn't have any money. I didn't get to get school lunch other than what was provided. And it was always something subpar. And it was always in a separate line. It always came with a, hey, look at him in the free line. It always came with some level of shaming. And that's what these people want. They want poverty to be something they can shame you over, while they steal from you to give to the very wealthy. When the Elon Musks of the world are telling us that, well, we got to tighten our belts, we got a problem. We've got a moral crisis in this country. Not just the nonsense that Trump's pulling, but if we stand for this, if you watched that on CNN, if you watched all those Fox people fall in the line and fawn, you got a problem. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So with all the chaos, all of the, you know, this is the chaos theory. I mean, this is, we're seeing right in front of us what 4 years of Donald Trump was. And I told you at the beginning of this, remember those 4 years, this will be worse. It's worse. And here to share some thoughts on just how much worse I've asked former Michigan Congressman Andy Levin to come share with us. Andy is a distinguished senior fellow over at American Progress. You can check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. Andy, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. It's great to see you.
So I guess the first question is are you glad you're not in Congress now?
You know, Rick, I loved serving in Congress, but now I'm working on a bunch of labor, climate change, environmental causes, all the things I've always done. And I guess it's not a terrible thing not to be in Congress right now. Although that said, we need my former colleagues, you know, the folks who are there now to, you know, to stand up and fight.
Yeah, find a spine.
For the working people of this country.
Yeah, find a spine. And I will also argue, find a message. Because look, as I've been saying, and my listeners, my audience is already tired of it, but the solutions will come out of the suffering. Their savagery is going to bring a massive amount of suffering. And out of that, we've got to go, no, this is the way forward. You know, as they're stealing money from CHIP programs and Medicaid programs and school lunch programs, we got to say, no, that's not the direction we want to go, and have a clear message of the direction and the vision that is going to be the antithesis of what they're doing.
100%. I mean, you know, personally, I think the most important thing that can happen in this country after November 5th, 2024, was the same thing that needed to happen before, which is we need to help a lot more workers in this union form unions and bargain collectively. And I just think that the election shows that. I mean, because, you know, people who are in union households, evidently, according to the exit polls, they voted as much more for Harris as they did more for Biden and so forth before in the years before, many years before. There's just too damn few many people that have a union anymore. I mean, 6% of the private sector. And then in the meantime, Trump has come out of the gate trying to do some kind of shock and awe thing where, you know, last time he didn't really know what he was doing. He's attracted to shiny objects, right? So he got some like fancy name people who he thought would be cool. Like, remember Rex Tillerson, wasn't that his first Secretary of State? He had some kind of normal corporate or business or academic types who got in there, and they're like, well, gee, I better follow the Constitution. I better actually read stuff. And it drove him crazy.
Should do my job.
People left and right. Now he's not making that quote unquote mistake again. He's everything you must, first, second, third criteria for being in Trump's cabinet is, and any other job is, you'll do whatever the hell he says, yep. Loyalty to him. And so they are rolling out these things like that, you know, freeze on funding. That's completely unconstitutional and ridiculous. I mean, but they did it, and he just wants to test every boundary to see what he can get away with.
No, that's what I said. This was you know, this was a jab to see how you were going to respond to this act. And what's interesting is there were a lot of people who bit. There was a lot of activity, a lot of focus, and I'm not quite sure yet if it was the right amount or not enough. Because I think, you know, we had to know that it was going to be shot down. We had to know that they would backpedal. But you know what I'm saying? I'm trying to get to that. As these things keep happening, and they're going to happen, the shiny thing gets our attention. I want to know what we missed while we were paying attention to that. Does that make sense?
No, it does. And I think people have a legitimate reason, right? He was able to appoint three members to the Supreme Court in his first term. He has a super majority of a very, very conservative. It's the most conservative court since the Lochner Court, you know, 90 years ago. And the decision they made, you know, about how he was immune, right, from any wrong thing he did when he was president, it was a shocking decision. And so, and they made, of course, a lot of other horrible decisions. But my point is, you know, people think, oh, the judiciary, they think about the Supreme Court, and they think, gosh, Trump will probably get away with whatever the heck he wants. No, no, we have to follow the law, follow the Constitution, and take legal action every time it's warranted when they do, you know, when they violate the law or violate the Constitution. But I think your point is really a good one. You know, what is the message here? You know, what should we be talking about and not just bouncing around following his everything? And I think the thing is, follow the money, right? Follow where who's being helped and who's being hurt. And we really need a government that works for the working people of this country. People get up and go to work every day. And does this, like, I think it's legitimate to talk about when he tried to cut funding. Does it make sense to try to undo everything Congress did under his first term, you know, the Biden term, to take care of the American people, to do the business of the people? You know, the way our government is set up, the Article One branch, the first branch set up in the Constitution, is the Congress, and the Article Two branch is the executive. Congress decides how much to spend, decides what to spend it on, and unless the president is able to veto that and get the veto sustained, that's the law. That's spending on those things, and the executive executes,
right,
carries out. And so, yes, does the president have some discretion about how exactly he carries it out? Of course he does. But does he get to come into office and get this like bulldozer and say, hey, we're not spending any of that money that many previous Congresses and administrations decided on? No, of course not. And who does it help and who does it hurt? You know, and if you stop all the projects being carried out to build roads, build bridges, build chips factories, you know, you throw a lot of people out of work. You take, a lot of things away from people. It was super injurious to the American people. And, you know, this kind of chaos and wrecking ball approach, I think, is going to be a big political disaster for Trump.
Yeah, I keep coming back to, you know, the 30% of the population that just they got the hat, man. They're wearing the shirt. They're flying the flag. The ink is, you know, evidently gotten into the brain. I don't know that they're ever coming around. And as I've said before, the hope is that the 70% of the rest of us, you know, wake up to their depravity, wake up to how bad it's going to be, and then act in 2 years to try and stop some of this. But for right now, you know, Trump has shown us that there's nothing he thinks, that there are no guardrails that he thinks he has to obey. And thanks to that Supreme Court decision, I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I think that you're right. There's like 30% who are with him no matter what. But I think a lot more Americans are so fed up with politics and with the kind of kleptocracy and the you know, corporations running everything.
No, I agree, Andy. I completely agree with that.
But don't you think, Rick, they just think like, look, Trump tells it like it is. They love how he just says whatever. He seems, you know, authentic. He's not following some script, right? And even though, so I think what's really incumbent on us is to just try to say, hey, what would actually help people? Like having good schools, having healthcare, having a lot of good jobs, having a union job, you know, making a great salary and benefits so you can support your family and have a retirement. Let's get those things. Is that what Trump's doing here?
No, he's never going to do that. Andy, we both know he's never going to. He doesn't care about working people.
We need the people to see it.
Yeah,
and I know Rick Smith has known this for a long time. That's not the problem.
No, but the point here for me is that my mind is in this place, and maybe you can help me find my way out of it, that the only way we're really ever going to come back together is when he destroys the economy, when he destroys everything right before our eyes, and we're standing and looking at a dumpster fire. And that there's mass suffering across the economy where people have no choice. The old labor frame, when your stomach gets empty, your head gets right. You know, the only time we ever unite in this country is around tragedy, chaos. You think Pearl Harbor, you think 9/11, you think those kind of tragedies. The only time we really come together, and I fear that that's what it's going to take, and that's where he's heading us.
Well, yeah, I don't even know what. It's so strange, right? Because we have so much more tragedy happening so much more often, like because of how the overheating of the planet is leading occasional floods to be frequent floods, small floods to be huge floods. Okay. And the same with wildfires and hurricanes and everything else. And, you know, the country is so fragmented. Yeah. You know, I don't know what's going to happen, Rick, but I do think that this chaos is, I don't think the American people are going to like it. I think they want, you know, this whole idea of like running the government like a business, that is attractive to a lot of people, right? That kind of line, absolutely. Even though those of us who've been in business and in government know that they're very different, right? But, and it takes different skills. But when you come in and say that, and then instead of running things like clockwork or very efficiently, you create a ton of chaos, then you don't have good government or efficiency or anything. You just have a big mess.
Right.
Trump is creating a huge mess.
No, look, I asked the question, you know, right when Trump took office. I said, look, you know, you want to run the country as a business. Look at your own life. Look at your boss. Do you want that person running the country? And overwhelmingly, people responded, no, my boss only cares about himself. He only cares about productivity. He only cares about how much money he's going to put in his pocket. He's always, going after us for breaks and lunches and hounding us and no vacation, no, you know, screwing us out of health care, screwing us out of retirement, goes all down this stuff. And I'm going, then why in the hell do you want to run the government like that?
That's right.
Why would you want to run our government like as badly as you've been treated? And I can only come back to, we have some kind of weird Stockholm syndrome with employers. It's the same thing with healthcare. I have no idea why you want your employer to hold your healthcare. It's maddening to me.
You know, I was just at a memorial event for a beloved older cousin who passed away, and there were people in the family who I never see because they live abroad, you know, and then one young, pretty young woman who lives in France and works there, she was like, I come to America and the healthcare situation is so horrifying. We would never accept this in France. The idea of like, do I have healthcare or not? Or, you know, is this covered or not? Or can I see this doctor or not? She's like, in France and, you know, and in other countries in Europe, you get healthcare, you get what you need. If you need a procedure, if you need medication, it's all there. And the idea in America that we don't have this and we're the richest country on earth is insane.
No, it's insane. And since you brought up healthcare, and I've been going through a healthcare nightmare since September, my wife's been in the hospital or in one frame or another. And these are the bills that I'm getting from her stay. That woman in France, she doesn't get this. Places that have healthcare as a right, they don't get this. There's like $2 million worth of bills there. And I'm going, okay. Fortunately, I have the best union healthcare in this country. I've got friends like you in Congress who have been jealous of the healthcare we get as Teamsters. But
you're
I'm
right.
Fortunate. I'm fortunate in this. I can't imagine if I didn't have the good fortune of carrying a union card in my wallet. I can't imagine what my life would be and how this healthcare system would have just chewed me up and spit me out. But that, again, is something that we've got to be reaching out to the American people with and saying, look, there is a better way. And then actually having a way to get there.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? Think back about like 2016, 2020. And people said, well, you know, like Bernie, a lot of people would say something like, well, because Bernie Sanders was having real success in primaries, right?
Yeah.
And people would say, well, you know, I actually agree with Bernie a lot, but we can't really, like, we can't go there,
can't
right?
Really do that.
Like, right? And actually, you know, at this point, isn't it worth asking ourselves, well, what if Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or whatever was our nominee? And they flat out just said, we're going to get health care for everybody. You know, everybody's going to make 15, 20 bucks an hour. We're not going to have sub-minimum wages for tipped workers. You know, we're going to have, and by the way, not only are we going to make Social Security solvent into the 21st century, but we're going to expand it. So we stop tying people's retirement security to what job they happen to have. And everybody who spends a lifetime of working and putting in will have a dignified retirement. I mean, if you talked bigger and sensible and just practical to the American people like that, I think we'd do a lot better.
I agree. But, you know, for me, I don't believe in saviors. I didn't believe Obama was the savior. I didn't think Biden was the savior. I loved Bernie. Bernie was the first person I ever interviewed doing this program back in 2005. So, you know, I love some of these guys, but they're not the savior. The savior is we, the voters, and yes. We've got to get our heads out of our behinds and start demanding this stuff. We should be demanding cradle to grave health care without worrying about if the kid breaks an arm, are we going to go bankrupt? We need a retirement security system that says, hey, if you work hard, you play by the rules, you get to retire with some dignity and some respect. We should be demanding this stuff as voters instead of this ridiculous back and forth of corporate speak and business friendly, and I just want government run like a business, which is the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
I mean, truthfully, if you like really believe in capitalism and say, well, this is a free market society, anybody who looks at it can see that the role of government is to set up a system where that stuff can function,
yep.
Not to be, you know, a business. It's to provide all the infrastructure that people need, right? The roads, the bridges, the hospitals, the schools. No, like, I'll tell you, you remember the bill? You remember when I introduced a bill called the EV Freedom Act, the, you know, Electric Vehicle Freedom Act?
I do.
And people are like, well, that's way too ambitious. Basically, I introduced a bill in 2020, I think, or whatever. And it said, look, the government needs to do the engineering and figure out the, you know, transportation planning and install a comprehensive network of high speed chargers throughout the whole national highway system within 3 years. And even the Democrats, like I loved Peter DeFazio. He's the chair of the transportation committee and he was a pretty liberal guy. Right. But his staff was like, Andy, that's too ambitious. You know, you can like tweak the EV, you know, the electrification corridors on the East and West Coast or something. And I was like, okay, this is my point, Rick. This is like for the businesses, this has to happen. In capitalism, nobody's going to make a lot of money putting infrastructure for the infancy of an end, right, for EVs.
Yep.
And yet now we see, since the bill didn't happen, right, Chevrolet has delayed introduction of model after model. These capitalist companies are American ones that we want to succeed with union workers, right, are losing billions of dollars because I'm not going to go buy a car if I can't visit grandma in Omaha or take my kid to, you know, whatever college or whatever they got to do, right? This is America. We got a road trip, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Or if I got to get a generator to keep in the trunk.
Exactly. So, you know, we should have done that,
absolutely.
Right? We should have done that. And government isn't a bit, government is about doing what's necessary so that we can lead a great life.
Yep.
You know,
and we could have done that with a public-private partnership if you had to. There's an
absolutely.
Infrastructure of gas stations. You could have easily put a charging, by us, Sheetz does it. They've got the gas over there. They got the chargers over there.
Right.
You could have incentivized that.
Or what about every hotel and restaurant? I mean, yep. Since the technology still takes about, even the high-speed stuff takes a half hour to take you to 80% charge. I mean, you could have said to, you know, whatever, Courtyard by Marriott versus a Hilton Garden Inn. Oh, are you going to let them have all the chargers at this exit? You know, you guys can bid on hosting them, yep. Right? And everybody's going to want to have some so that the people spend the night there or come to Chili's versus, you know, TGI Friday, whatever. Yep. All the businesses would want to host it. So you're exactly right. It wouldn't have cost the taxpayers much money, if anything. And we could have, you know, catalyzed much more economic activity, and instead we're like, oh, you know, government can't do that. There's no ambition anymore. And that's
absolutely
isn't this the most ironic thing, Rick? People are like, America, we got to make America great. Like, hold on, do you just want to trash things and go backwards to what? If you're thinking about an idea of American greatness, wasn't it when, like, we were the arsenal of democracy? Wasn't it when we put the world on wheels? Don't you want to lead the technological revolutions that are coming next? And have that's why I'm so proud of the things we did in the 117th Congress when Biden's first 2 years were there. we did pass the Inflation Reduction Act and the Chips and Science Act and the infrastructure bill that was the closest thing we've had to an industrial policy. It was far from perfect, right? Yeah. Far from adequate. But it was the closest thing we had to an industrial policy in decades, really since Lyndon Johnson. And, you know, now we're in this mess.
And the answer, I think you hit on it right there, bold vision. We need Democrats to get their heads out of their keisters, ball up the digits, get in their fight, and have a bold vision for the future. But, Andy, as always, I appreciate you sharing some of your insights, some of your passion thoughts. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Rick. Take care. Good luck to you and your wife.
I appreciate it. Former Michigan Congressman Andy Levin, distinguished senior fellow there at American Progress. I want to hear your thoughts. Do you see that bold vision coming out? And what would be part of it? What would you, as a working person, want to see that bold vision encompass? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Back after this.
News from the Center, WRCE. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. A partly cloudy sky for tonight, lows in the upper teens. And turning mostly cloudy for tomorrow, highs in the mid-30s. Then some rain and snow showers around tomorrow night before it warms up to the upper 40s for a high Sunday and partly sunny. Right now it's 36.
The Todd Alba Show.
The argument from my former party has been, it's not the guns, it's mental health. Well, no worries, folks. Governor Evers has got you covered. He introduced a plan to put millions of dollars into mental health, particularly for young kids. And the Republicans in the chamber did not clap. If you can't be it for kids, then what the heck can you be for? Jeepers, criminy.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, we're seeing stories out of Philadelphia of workplaces, schools, churches. ICE is going everywhere. You know, where people work, where people worship, where people go to school. You know, things where you want people to be. No, I guess we just want to force them underground as they're going after the people who are here in an undocumented fashion. And it got me thinking today, because you remember back when we were in high school and we were forced to read that Upton Sinclair book, The Jungle? We learned about how terrible working conditions were in America back in the old days in the meatpacking plants. Remember that? And how they were depicted as grim and dehumanizing hellholes where workers endured long, grueling hours, paid desperation wages, toiled in deplorably hazardous conditions. Remember that? Ah, the old days. The plants prioritized profits over people, over safety, and treated people like garbage, expendable, disposable. Question is, did we learn anything? And this is the question I ask about having read 1984. Did you see that as a cautionary tale or a playbook, as the how-to? And the thing is, we're hearing stories from meatpacking plants today where one could hardly distinguish between then and well now. And my next guest has written what is being called the modern-day version of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. And on February 1st, investigative radio program Reveal, he is going to be hosting a podcast episode looking at the meatpacking plant in Greeley, Colorado. That's why I've asked Ted Greenaway to come share some thoughts with us. He's also the author of The Chain, Farm, Factory, and the Fate of Our Food. Ted, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on, Rick. I appreciate it.
So I start with that comparison. Your book, you know, being, compared to Sinclair's The Jungle, and, you know, how 100 years doesn't seem to make any difference in the meatpacking industry.
Yeah, well, it's true that really since the beginning of meatpacking as an industrialized process, the work has always been so hazardous and so extremely tedious and difficult that it has been the job that we tend to give to people who are the newest arrivals. And it's very much the case now that because of changes that had taken place maybe 20 years ago, and crackdowns with the advent of ICE and meatpacking plants being specifically targeted for raids, that the industry has tended to focus on trying to hire refugees and asylum seekers, people who are vulnerable and new arrivals, but are here legally and therefore are deportation proof. But now, with some of the changes that are taking place with the new administration, there's the threat that many of the people who are working in these plants will have their status revoked and will be subject to deportation.
Yeah, again, another level of exploitation. We're going to get all the grueling work out of you. And if you get hurt, we'll kick you to the curb. But now that threat of ICE coming to get you is even more palpable. But what do you say to the person? Because, look, you know, when we did our 2022 Working Class Heroes Tour, we ended up in a place called Ottumwa, Iowa, where Tom Arnold is from. And you know, Tom was on the program talking about how he worked in the Hormel meat plant and how they, when they went on strike in the 80s, you know, they destroyed those jobs. You know, these jobs, we're told, are only jobs that people like that will take. And the argument for going after them is, well, we're going to get them out and we're going to bring regular people in. Do you buy any of that?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned Ottumwa and that's that Hormel strike. That the book The Chain is really focused on Hormel Foods and really focuses on that particular strike. And one of the things that happened was that the company was eager to try to break the union, in part because they were doing more and more automation, and these jobs were turning from skilled positions, knife positions, to positions that were more and more automated and mechanized and could be done by unskilled labor. And so the goal was to pay people less, bring them in, and to, you know, use them up and replace them then. And one of the things that happened is that these jobs not only became lower paying, but they became repetitive and subject to, you know, repetitive stress injuries. And so saying, well, you know, these jobs used to be done by Americans who would be happy to do these jobs again, these are not the same jobs that people had when they were working in these plants in the 1980s. And I think in this particular case, looking at what's happening at the JBS plant, the beef packing plant in Greeley, Colorado, it's a great example that the group of Haitian workers that were recruited to come in to work at that plant and put on the B shift, the night shift at the plant, The union claims that the line during the daytime is usually running between 250 to 300 head of cattle per hour. It also says that the line that was made up of the Haitian workers who were brought in, who didn't know how fast the line was supposed to be working, didn't know what their union representation was and those sorts of things, that they were running the line at more than 400 head per hour. And at times it speeds up to 430 head per hour.
Wow.
So what you've got is this desire to try to bring people in who are working at incredibly high speeds and at dangerous speeds. And if they decide that those are jobs that they can't do anymore or don't want to do anymore, you just pull in the next wave of immigrants to do that job. But I think it's an interesting moment now that the question is, well, what happens if suddenly all the people who we've relied on for a generation to do these jobs are suddenly removed from that position? I think there's a real moral question about what we've promised to the people who we brought to this country, especially as refugees and asylum seekers. But there's also the question of what are we going to do if we don't have the whole workforce that we rely on to make our food?
Right. Well, I mean, we're either going to pay really high prices, or we're going to have to figure out how to grow stuff ourselves. Maybe, you know, we're going to maybe set up slaughterhouses in our backyards, which I've had people tell me we need to go back to. You know, these factory farms are bad. We need to go back to small, local, which I'm not entirely opposed to. I just don't know that it's functional. But, you know, I go back to that Hormel strike. It's my understanding that there were still some people there who weren't there in a documented fashion. This industry seems to always attract undocumented workers because, look, not a lot of Americans want to do these jobs, even at the wages they were making back then. What do you say to that?
Yeah, so it's really true that after that Hormel strike in the 80s and the union was effectively broken, the P9 that ran that particular plant in Austin, Minnesota was rolled into the larger union and never had the same power, that there was a very quick replacement of the workforce there. And through various maneuvers, the traditional workforce was replaced largely with undocumented workers by the early 90s. Where that changed was with a series of raids that were carried out all in one day in December 2006, when the Bush administration was the George W. Bush administration was testing out this new organization that they had created that was the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. And this group that had been created, that we've been told was going to be counterterrorism, that was going to be part of Homeland Security, instead, its very first action was to carry out the largest workplace raid that had ever been seen in the U.S. And it brought the company, Swift & Company, to its knees. The company within a year was forced to sell itself to JBS, a big international corporation, because they were not ever able to get staffed up again to the level to be running at full capacity. And so the industry recognized the danger at that point of relying too heavily on undocumented labor. But the move was, how do we find people who are not as culturally connected in the same way, don't know their rights as workers, aren't connected to the union, don't have community ties? And the solution was refugees. We can find people who are in every way the same as undocumented workers, except they have legal status. And that has been the direction that the whole industry has gone. And they've gone really hard in that way, especially in recent years, so that a plant like the plant in Greeley, the union says it's between 80 and 90% of the workers who were born outside of the United States. And almost the entire second shift is made up of people who have temporary protected status that was granted to them by the Biden administration. Well, if all of those people have their status rescinded all at once, what's going to happen to that plant? What's going to happen to all of those people who are here because they were seeking humanitarian asylum? What responsibility do we have to them? But also, you know, if there's overnight, there's no one to run these plants, what's going to happen to our food supply?
That's an excellent question. And it's not like JBS couldn't pay a reasonable wage or couldn't hire Americans at a reasonable wage. They're the largest company, meat producer in the world, I understand. Had revenues last year of upwards of $76 billion. This is a big behemoth company who could pay. They just choose not to.
Yeah, well, and JBS has a lot of allegations well beyond the concerns about how the workers are being treated at this particular plant. I mean, the JBS is fascinating right now. This is part of a lawsuit against them and three of the other largest beef producers that has been brought by McDonald's and by Kroger and Cisco, the largest food distributors. And what they're alleging is price fixing, and saying that JBS, at the same time that they are working in various ways to suppress wages, that they are also then in communication with other companies to keep the supply artificially low in order to keep prices high. And so this is the danger when you get too much consolidation, that you end up with companies that have this real stranglehold over the most basic of our needs. I mean, they control our food.
Yeah. Now, when you're talking about these stories, because, you had mentioned a moment ago that they recruited these Haitians to come in. And in these situations, I have spoken to people who have worked in facilities like this before, and they always, the company always uses language barriers and ethnic differences to keep people at bay, keep them at each other, as opposed to organizing. Are we finding the same kind of environment there in Greeley? That, because you said they recruited them, I got to think that some of that plays.
Yeah. So, I mean, the issue is that as the union tells it, that coming out of the COVID pandemic and the plant experienced hundreds of illnesses and six deaths, that even the federal government, the finding was that the company had been not responsible in providing the kind of protective gear that was necessary to keep the workers healthy and alive. And so coming out of that, the union worked really hard to negotiate for better health benefits, for better worker protections, so that this sort of thing wouldn't happen again. And what the union says is that they think that there was a kind of corporate retaliation against this workforce for insisting on these conditions. And in fact, they were able to negotiate for better conditions at that plant than at some of the others that are similar in other parts of the country. And so the union says that they think that when this Haitian workforce was initially targeted to try to fill a few vacancies, but then they realized that there was a huge group of people who wanted to fill these jobs, the union says, we think that they were intentionally firing people who had been part of this effort to push for higher wages and for better benefits and to replace them with people who didn't have any idea what their rights were and would work at almost, you know, twice the speed that people on the day shift were being asked to work.
Now, again, I want to go back to what you said a moment ago. If Trump does clear all these people out, you know, what then does happen to this company? I mean, you know, not that I care. This is a big, giant company. They could pay people good wages. We could make these family-sustaining wage jobs. But what do you think then happens?
I mean, I think the only thing that we have as a kind of roadmap is what happened to Swift and Company in 2006. And like I said, for months, they had to run at reduced capacity because they didn't have enough people to staff up the plants. And eventually, because they had been hit in six different locations and it really hobbled their production across the company, they made the decision to sell off and became part of what is now JBS. If Trump is going to try to hit the numbers of deportations that he says that he's aiming for, 15 to 20 million people, you'd have to be carrying out workplace raids like this, 10 of those kinds of raids every single day for 4 years. And I just don't see how that's logistically possible in terms of the manpower to carry out those raids and the capacity to hold the people that you, I mean, where are you going to put 15 to 20 million people? But I also think, you know, it would devastate the economy. And so it's hard for me to imagine that this is what actually happens. What the union has said that they expect, and I think is reasonable, is that they think that the status will be revoked for temporary protected status, but that they will be given a classification that is a work visa status that would essentially tie their presence in the U.S. to their employment and would make them even more beholden to their employers than they are now.
Yeah, that's horrible. I mean, that you just went from bad to worse, in my view.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I think that there's every reason to expect that may be what'll happen.
Because that's basically indentured servitude. I mean, you don't come to work and do this job to my satisfaction. Well, we're just going to turn you in. They're going to cart you out of here.
That's right. And again, I just want to remind everyone that the people that we're talking about here, the Haitian workers that we're talking about, for example, in order to enter the U.S. Under that temporary protected status, they had to demonstrate that their lives were in imminent danger in Haiti. So the people that I talked to for this story, there was one person who had been shot. There was one person who had been beaten almost to death. There were people who had specific threats from the gangs that control Port-au-Prince and the rest of Haiti. These are not people who can just go back to Haiti and pick up their lives. I mean, these are people who there's a real threat of death if they get sent back.
You know, I mean, we just saw on Wednesday, you know, the Trump folks announced that they were revoking protective status for 600,000 Venezuelans. Right. You know, where's that going to go? And this is going to be interesting to see where they play this out because, look, you know, there's 46% of the country thinks Trump's doing a great job. And this is all part of that. So as I've been saying, you know, the solutions will come out of the suffering caused by their savagery, and this is part of that. So last, you know, line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, most people
don't think this stuff is going on. They think, they don't look behind the curtain, don't really care. Is there a way? I know you guys are doing the podcast over at Reveal, the investigative reporting podcast. Is there a way of getting this to more ears and eyes of just how deplorable some of these conditions are and some of the conditions that, maybe we may end up having to fight over?
Well, these are certainly the stories that we're trying to tell and trying to get people to share. I hope, your listeners and will listen to the whole episode and share it around with people. I hope it'll be something that we pay attention to, because certainly it affects our food and our food prices. But I can't say enough. I mean, what the administration is talking about is rescinding the status for a total of, more than a million people. And the idea that there may be a million people who we let into this country because they were seeking asylum here, because their lives were at risk, that we're going to put them onto military planes and fly them back to where they could be killed. It's just something that I feel like it is something that would stain the soul of our country in the way that slavery did, that the Trail of Tears did, the way that the Japanese internment camps did. And we always ask ourselves, what would we have done if we were alive during those times, if there's something that we could have done?
Yep.
I think that moment is here.
Here we are.
We just have to let it be known that we don't want this sort of thing done in our names.
No, well, look, they're opening up Guantanamo Bay. Going to take 30,000 migrants to Guantanamo Bay. I don't know what worse message you can send than that.
You're exactly right. It's clearly meant to send a message, and the thing is that declares who we are as a country. And I think it's our responsibility. If we don't agree with that, we got to make sure that that's known.
There you go. The Reveal podcast. You can find that wherever you get your favorite podcasts. February 1st, it will drop. Make sure you find that. Ted Greenaway's the author of The Chain, Farm, Factory, and the Fate of Our Food. He's going to be your host walking through all of that. I'm looking forward to it, Ted. Good work. I can't wait to hear it. And I hope to talk to you again real soon.
Great. Thanks very much, Rick.
I want to hear your thoughts. Do you care? This is one of those moments. Do you care? And then we can go from there. Sadly, I've met a lot of people who said they don't care. In fact, I met one woman who said, I sleep better knowing he's going after them. Is that who we are? I want to hear it. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1865. That was the day the United States Congress passed the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, abolishing slavery. President Abraham Lincoln had already issued the Emancipation Proclamation, but there was worry that the proclamation, an emergency wartime measure, would not stand up in the courts after the war had ended. The introduction of the amendment first occurred in 1864 as the Civil War raged on. That meant that only Northern legislators were present to debate the issue. Despite this, the amendment failed to pass the House of Representatives. Determined to ensure its passage on the second try, President Lincoln made the amendment part of the National Republican platform for the presidential election. He lobbied heavily for the bill and was able to win enough support for its passage. The New York Times described the scene after the vote in the House of Representatives, writing, "No attempt was made to suppress the applause, which came from all sides, everyone feeling that the occasion justified the fullest expression of approbation and joy." The final amendment read, "Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist in the United States or any place, subject to their jurisdiction." The amendment then had to be ratified by 3/4 of the states. The ratification marked a fundamental change in the labor system of the United States. No more would the nation be divided by free labor and slave labor laws. Kentucky did not officially ratify the 13th Amendment until 1976, and Mississippi did not follow until 1995. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So learn something this week. Learn that Sheldon Whitehouse, the senator from Rhode Island, had been a former law school roommate with Robert Kennedy Jr. Evidently, RFK Jr. and them have been longtime friends. And at the confirmation hearing, Sheldon Whitehouse said, frankly, you frighten people. And yeah, even conservatives are freaked out. Even some of the people that I still view as somewhat sane, who can call themselves conservative, even they're a little, they're freaked out by RFK Jr. and this idea that we're going to make polio great again. And the push for this whole anti-vax movement and the pseudoscience that he brings. It's kind of concerning. Now, what I thought also was interesting during his hearing, it's one of those things where you go, you know, what does he really think? And evidently, he said on Wednesday during the hearing that most Americans are not happy with Medicaid because the premiums are too high. Now, this is under friendly questioning. This is a Republican asking this question about, you know, what's going on. And understand, Medicaid, they don't have premiums because it's for the poor. It's for the indigent. It's for folks who are at the bottom of the spectrum. And the fact of the matter is that if you're getting Medicaid, you're struggling. Now, what he said is, in reality, the vast majority of Medicaid enrollees pay nothing for health care coverage. But the point of the program to ensure low-income Americans cannot afford private health insurance or out-of-pocket medical care. RFK Jr. proved himself out of his depth, even under friendly Republican questioning. And, you know, for me, when you go, you don't even know what the basic program is. How can you be the guy who's in charge of it? How can we allow someone like RFK Jr. to be in charge of something that he doesn't actually understand, even the rudimentary parts of it? Now, you could go, well, you know, the ACA was based on expanding Medicaid and making Medicaid available to everyone. And then if your income was above a certain level, that you would then have to pay the difference to get you down to Medicaid level, creating kind of a sliding scale. As you earn more, you pay a little bit into the system. Maybe in the most charitable ways, maybe, but I don't think so. I think he was put into that position for one reason and one reason only, and that is chaos. That is to, from within, destroy the system. Because understand, Republicans have been against Medicaid and Medicare. They've been against all of this from the start. So there's nothing in this that makes me go, oh, gee, they picked probably one of the least qualified people to run the agency. And gee, where do you think they're going to run it? They're going to run it right into the ground. And out of that, you know, millions of people are going to suffer. Poor people are going to suffer because they're not going to get health care. And the elderly are going to suffer because that's how we pay for long-term care for people who are indigent. There's something really, really wrong with RFK Jr. being the head. Now, are there things that I agree with him on? There are some things. You know, a blind squirrel finds a nut occasionally. I do think our food supply has a lot of problems. I think handing it over to big corporate interests, a lot of problems, as we just talked about. I think there's an awful lot that we should be doing to reel in big ag and corporate food. There's an awful lot. We should be looking at getting rid of a lot of high fructose corn syrup and all this stuff that he talks about. I could come along with. But when you start talking about a lot of the kookery that we normally get out of him, I don't know. Don't know. But I do want to hear your thoughts. You know, head of HHS, you okay with that? Is that a good thing? Good place for him? Rick at RickSmithShow.com. Seriously, I don't know where to go with that. Cannot believe we're here. But that's going to be the statement we're going to come up with every day for the next 4 years. Can you believe what happened today? They say, may you live in interesting times. Oh, boy, do we. Oh, boy, howdy. I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at the RickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Grab the podcast. And as always, Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center, and always on the Civic Media app.
This is a special report from ABC News. I'm Richard Cantu.
Houses on fire. They trying to put it out there. You see kids running out. It's not right, man.
That man on the northeast side of Philadelphia, where a jet ambulance crashed into a busy neighborhood right after takeoff.
I definitely saw debris falling. There's all over Cotton.
A fellow named Jay was there.
A bus was going down Cotton.
Okay.
And I guess the explosion hit it and caught on fire.
Officials are not talking about how many fatalities there have been. Mayor Sherelle Parker telling people basically to just stay out of the area.
Just stay in your home. Again, it's still an active scene and it's under investigation.
No word on cause of the crash, but the jet ambulance, a Learjet 55, according to the Federal Aviation Administration, was 43 years old. This is ABC News. ABC's Jim Ryan. It's already Saturday in the Middle East. Another hostage release.